Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 232, entitled, Can You Picture Us in London? Or, How the United Kingdom Lost the Second World War. In the movie Casablanca, people are probably familiar with the scene in which Humphrey Bogart sits down with the Nazis at his table in Rick's Cafe, and at one point, as they're discussing Germany's good military fortune in the early part of World War II, one of the Nazis says to Rick, a.k.a. Humphrey Bogart, can you picture us in London? And Humphrey Bogart says something to the effect of, ask me when you get there. Well, they have gotten there. And one of the things to understand as you listen to this program is the continuity between the Third Reich in its overground phase or above ground phase and the Third Reich in its underground phase, which exists to this day, and also the continuity of policy between military conquest and economic conquest. We will go into that at greater length. And in the background of all of this is the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization, the economic and political component of the Third Reich gone underground. The focal point of this broadcast is going to be German finance, its connection with the Bormann Group and the Third Reich in its overground and underground phases, and also the takeover, primarily the takeover of the London Bourse by the Deutsche Börse, that is the London Stock Exchange by the German Stock Exchange. And again, bear in mind that famous scene from Casablanca where the German asks, the Nazi officer asks Humphrey Bogart as Rick, can you picture us in London? Reading now from the Wall Street Journal of Wednesday, May 3rd of the year 2000, this is an article by Sylvia Ascarelli, Ascarelli, of the Wall Street Journal. It's Dateline London. It's headlined, London Bourse's Leading Role Hinges on Merger with Frankfurt. Subtitle, Likely Deal Signals a Need for Allies. NASDAQ Gains Clout. NASDAQ is the high-tech stock exchange in this country. More about that later. The article reads in part, in a move that would have been unthinkable a decade ago, London Stock Exchange is moving swiftly toward a merger with its German counterpart. Is London, quote, on the brink of surrender, unquote, to foreigners? As one British newspaper recently suggested. That again from the Wall Street Journal of May 3rd of the year 2000. I would suggest that it is no longer on the brink of surrender. It is past that point. What is being represented in most media is not in fact a merger at all, but is in fact for all intents and purposes, a takeover of the London Stock Exchange by the Deutsche Börse, or certainly a dominance of it. Reading now from the New York Times of Thursday, May 4th of the year 2000, about this merger, this is an article by Edmund L. Andrews. It's headlined, City of London and Frankfurt, subtitled, A German-Energized Market Merger in the New Europe. And again, picture that scene in Casablanca where the Nazi officer asks Humphrey Bogart, can you picture us in London? This is Dateline Frankfurt, May 3rd. It reads, actually reads in part, the remark would normally provoke little notice. But coming from Werner G. Seifert, S-E-I-F-E-R-T, chief executive of Germany's stock exchange, it was startling. Quote, there's no reason why we have to be headquartered in Frankfurt, Mr. Seifert remarked at a dinner late in January. Again quoting, I could imagine myself living in London. Why not? Unquote. Today, Mr. Seifert announced that he would indeed be moving to London. In a stunning development, Deutsche Börse, the parent company of the Frankfurt stock market, confirmed that it would merge with the London Stock Exchange and that Mr. Seifert would be chief executive of the new company. It is the most advanced step yet taken toward creating a pan-European securities market, uniting the continent's two biggest exchanges into a single corporation that will be nearly twice as big as the next contender, the recently announced merger of the Paris, Amsterdam, and Brussels markets. In also announcing an alliance with NASDAQ, the new exchange could become the European anchor for a global trading system available 24 hours a day. Note the link with NASDAQ. We're going to be coming back to that later in the program. Continuing with this article from the New York Times of 5/4/2000. But the most remarkable aspect of the deal may be the extent to which Mr. Seifert and the Frankfurt Exchange, until recently, a secondary market, are calling the shots. London is now nearly twice as large as Frankfurt in terms of stock trading, and the financial district, the City of London, is by far Europe's biggest center for investment banking and trading. The idea that a Frankfurt executive might suddenly be in charge would, as I skip to the inside page, the idea that a Frankfurt executive might suddenly be in charge would until very recently have seemed absurd. Frankfurt is a city of bankers more than traders, a quiet place compared with London and its thousands of brokers, traders, analysts, deal makers, information merchants, and back office workers. Yet Mr. Seifert, who came to Frankfurt from Switzerland, has turned the old order upside down. Not only will he be chief executive of the new exchange to be called IX, short for International Exchanges, but London will give up its own electronic trading system in favor of Frankfurt's Xetra system. That's spelled X-E-T-R-A. More, skipping down. Indeed, some British bankers said the merger represented a German takeover because of the use of German technology and the appointment of Mr. Seifert as chief executive. One investment banker said it was noteworthy that high growth and new companies would be listed in Frankfurt, in effect making it the new economy center of Europe. The banker, who insisted on anonymity, added that the differing ownership structures of the London and Frankfurt exchanges meant that shareholdings in the merged company would be heavily weighted toward the big German banks that dominate the Deutsche Börse. Note a couple of things here. First of all, note the Swiss heritage of Mr. Seifert, and note also this last statement. The banker, who insisted on anonymity, added that the differing ownership structures of the London and Frankfurt exchanges meant that shareholdings in the merged company would be heavily weighted toward the big German banks that dominate the Deutsche Börse. We're going to talk about those big German banks and their relationship with the Third Reich in its above-ground and underground phases, and the Bormann Group in particular, later in the program. More from the New York Times of 5/4/2000. What we're going to talk about here is Mr. Seifert's role in merging the Swiss futures market with that of Frankfurt to create Eurex, and in turn the Eurex's role in eclipsing the London International Financial Futures Exchange, or FTSE as it's known, and the Chicago Board of Trade. 2 years ago, Mr. Seifert merged Frankfurt's market for futures and options with that of its Swiss competitor to form Eurex. That's, by the way, capital E-U-R-E-X. Last year, Eurex became the world's biggest derivatives market, eclipsing not only the London International Financial Futures Exchange, but also the Chicago Board of Trade. More about the Chicago Board of Trade and its use of the Xetra system. The Chicago Board of Trade is planning a collaborative electronic platform with Deutsche Börse that will be based on Xetra as well. And still more about the Eurex and its eclipsing of and isolation of the FTSE, or London Futures Exchange, still from the New York Times of 5/4/2000. And Eurex, the Deutsche Börse's market for derivatives, complex financial contracts whose values are derived from underlying assets like stocks, bonds, commodities, and currencies, would continue to be run from Germany as part of the combined exchange. The role of Eurex, the world's biggest derivatives market in the pan-European exchange, could effectively isolate the London International Financial Futures and Options Exchange, a chief rival. Participants said the Frankfurt-London merger would be completed by the fall, but the replacement of London's trading system with Germany's advanced technology is not expected until at least sometime in the first half of 2001. And skipping down again in this article, Britain's position outside the Eurozone also means that London-listed blue chips, including giants like BP Amoco, will be quoted in both euros and pounds. Some bankers expressed concerns about the costs of clearing and settlement in the merged market. The Deutsche Börse owns 50% of the Luxembourg-based Clearstream settlement system, which is not included in the merger. And note here that the problem in quoting stock prices in euros and pounds may very well lead later. It is not mentioned here, but don't be surprised that this ultimately leads to greater control by the Deutsche Börse. And we're going to talk about this again in the context of the European Monetary Union. Now, note also that this new German-dominated quote, merger, unquote, of the Deutsche Börse with the London Stock Exchange has a link with NASDAQ. And also note that this eclipses the combined French, Dutch, and Belgian stock market, stock exchange mergers. More now about the IEX, its relationship to other continental European stock exchanges, its eclipsing of those, and also perhaps its eventual absorption of those, and even more importantly, its connection with NASDAQ. We're going to read now from the Wall Street Journal of May 4th of the year 2000. This also is an article by Silvia Ascarelli, A-S-C-A-R-E-L-L-I. Stateline London headlined, New European Exchange Links with NASDAQ, subtitled London and Frankfurt to Meld, U.S. Market Will Join Growth Stock Venture. Skipping down, we read, The creation of IEX is likely to trigger consolidation among Europe's costly network of companies handling the clearing and settlement of securities trades. The deal also should promote convergence in the way European stock markets are regulated. The Milan and Madrid bourses yesterday signed a letter of intent to join IEX in 2001. A spokesman for Swiss Exchange said it also was approached and would study the offer. Yesterday's announcement trumps the plan of the Belgian, French, and Dutch bourses to merge into an exchange called Euronext. That planned exchange will need to sign up more partners or risk being swallowed up by IEX. Note again that Milan, the Italian stock exchange, and Madrid, the Spanish stock exchange, have signed a letter of intent to join IEX in 2001. And it seems probable here, that from the context that the French, Dutch, and Belgian merged market called Euronext will eventually be absorbed by the German-dominated IEX as well. Now, note also that this particular merge, the IEX, is also linking with NASDAQ, and there's discussion here of an eventual absorption of NASDAQ by the German-dominated IEX. Again, from the Wall Street Journal of 5/4/2000. The two exchanges also announced a joint venture with NASDAQ to build a pan-European market for growth stocks to be based on Germany's Neuer Markt, London's Tech Mark, and the top 100 NASDAQ-listed companies. It will be linked to NASDAQ in the U.S., and its soon-to-be-launched Japanese growth market paving the way for round-the-clock trading in the biggest companies as soon as early next year. These links mark, quote, one step in evolution toward creating a marketplace for the 21st century, unquote, said Frank Zarb, chief executive of NASDAQ. Formally, the European exchanges and NASDAQ said only that they will look into further cooperation, including cross-shareholdings. But the cooperation with NASDAQ eventually could lead to a merger of that exchange with IEX, said Gavin Casey, who plans to depart as chief executive of the London Stock Exchange once the IEX merger is completed. That's the end game, unquote, he said, speaking of the eventual absorption of NASDAQ, the U.S. high-tech stock exchange, into the IEX. And that, from the soon-to-depart chief executive of the London Stock Exchange, who is going to be giving way to his German counterpart, Werner Seifert, and more about Mr. Seifert later. Now, note again a very important piece of information from the New York Times of 5/4/2000, repeating this particular article, and again, this is from the New York Times article by Edmund L. Andrews entitled, A German-energized market merger in the new Europe, skipping down. Britain's position outside the Eurozone also means that London-listed blue chips, including giants like BP and Amoco, will be quoted in both euros and pounds. Some bankers expressed concerns about the costs of clearing and settlement in the merged market. The Deutsche Börse owns 50% of the Luxembourg-based Clearstream settlement system, which is not included in the merger. Well, Britain's position outside of the European Monetary Union, which it is for the time being, is ultimately pressuring the United Kingdom into some of the deals with the German-dominated European Monetary Union, and what basically constitutes to a considerable extent now a victory by Germany in the Second World War, albeit one 50 years after the military hostilities were concluded, and one through the matter of economics rather than military conquest. In For the Record program number 99, we noted that during the Second World War, there was a fusing of political and economic policy under the Nazi Party and the German armed forces with that of the German corporations, and a corporatist strategy for conquest was formed, which basically used German military conquest to subsume the economic and political structures of other countries in Europe, and the corporations and the economic power of those countries were then absorbed into, or at least dominated by, the German corporations, and then these corporations were entered into world markets with this greatly enhanced capability. This particular strategy was a continuation of a pan-German policy for conquest that dates back to 1840, or the 1840s, and was developed by a fellow named Friedrich Liszt. Liszt, again writing in the 1840s, proposed that a German-dominated, economically united Europe be used as a vehicle not only for unseating Great Britain as the dominant colonial power on Earth, but also for eventually conquering the world as a whole. Of course, the United States is now the dominant Anglo-Saxon power on Earth, not the United Kingdom, and with the takeover of the London Stock Exchange, because that's basically what it is, by the Deutsche Börse, in effect, the policies formulated by Friedrich Liszt in the 1840s and realized through the weakening and usurpation of Britain's position in the world over two world wars through a combination of military, political, and economic maneuvering by Germany, ultimately what Liszt proposed vis-a-vis the United Kingdom has now taken place. That's the significance of the title, Can You Picture Us in London? Friedrich Liszt wrote in the 1840s, and what we're going to do now is to hear about his policies as described by Paul Winkler in a book entitled The Thousand-Year Conspiracy, subtitled Secret Germany Behind the Mask. That book was published by Charles Scribner & Sons, copyright 1943. Note that Paul Winkler, again W-I-N-K-L-E-R, is an expert or was an expert on pan-Germanism, and that he was writing this in 1943, almost a half century ago, and discussing the policies of Friedrich Liszt formulated approximately a century before that. This program is excerpted from For the Record program number 85, entitled The Coming of the European Monetary Union, recorded in February of 1985. In a section of the book entitled Starvation as a Springboard, Winkler writes, Friedrich Liszt, along with several minor economists active around 1840, was responsible for formulating the principal theories on which present-day German economic conquest is based. After emigrating to Pennsylvania and becoming an American citizen, Liszt was concerned only with Germany's greatness. He returned to Germany in 1840 to publish there his principal work, in which he outlined the basis for his national system of political economy. Violently opposed to the principle of free trade because it gives the same advantages to weak as to strong nations, he would welcome its use without reservation within the continent of Europe once the continent were dominated by Berlin, and he had high hopes that this would be achieved as soon as possible. So far as his own age was concerned, however, he was an extreme protectionist and advocated development of new industry in Germany through high protective tariffs raised against competition of foreign countries. He took into full account the risk of losing Germany's foreign markets, since protectionism always provokes reprisals. His remedy is simple. Stimulate tremendous expansion of Germany, including conquest of Europe, acquisition of colonies in Australia, New Zealand, India, and the Americas. Then, Germany would no longer have to fear that she might lack foreign markets in a protectionist world. According to Liszt, a nation must conquer all countries lying in its sphere of economic action, by degrees, but steadily. And this sphere of action, is defined as every territory which may serve as outlet or which contains raw materials the nation may need. In the long run, this becomes perpetual conquest, for virtually every foreign country, however distant, represents a potential export market or is a producer of useful raw materials. In the ideas of Liszt, we find the economic basis for General von Bernhardi's thesis. That's capital B-E-R-N-H-A-R-D-I. Quote, for us, there are two alternatives and no third, world dominion or ruin. And skipping down, more about Liszt's formulas for economic domination. Charles Andler, capital A-N-D-L-E-R, a French author, summed up certain ideas of Liszt in his work, The Origins of Pan-Germanism, published in 1915. it is necessary to organize continental Europe against England. Napoleon I, a great strategist, also knew the methods of economic hegemony. His continental system, which met with opposition even from countries which might have profited from such an arrangement, should be revived, but this time, not as an instrument of Napoleonic domination. The idea of uniting Europe in a closed trade bloc is no longer shocking if Germany assumes domination over such a bloc and not France. One more time, because that is exactly what the European Monetary Union is. It is the realization of the ideas and the theories of Liszt. Quote, "The idea of uniting Europe in a closed trade bloc is no longer shocking if Germany assumes domination over such a bloc and not France, Belgium, Holland, Switzerland, and not France, excuse me. Belgium, Holland, Switzerland, willingly or by force, will enter this customs federation. Austria is assumed to be won over at the outset. Even France, if she gets rid of her notions of military conquest, will not be excluded. The first steps the Confederation would take to assure unity of thought and action would be to establish a joint representative body, as well as to organize a common fleet. But of course, both the headquarters of the Federation and its parliamentary seat would be in Germany." Well, the European Commission is in fact just such a parliament. The European Parliament is more a ceremonial body. And I would note that the European Monetary Institute is going to be in Frankfurt. Continuing, "At once the sharing of common commercial advantages would begin. Liszt proposes something like a cooperative league of nations in which all profits would be distributed in proportion to investments. European vitality, intelligence, and order would put the Far East to good use. Oriental ports would become free cities," unquote, "where European agents would deal with native authorities in the capacity of advisors duly accredited and diplomatically protected. Austria would extend its borders to the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf. A German navy would be built up, Prussian colonies would be established in Australia and New Zealand, where England has firmly planted her flag but failed to exploit resources. How could England resist all the navies and the concentrated economic power of a united Central Europe? Since Germany possesses a greater stock of vital energy and superior economic ability to that of any other nation," by the way, this, of course, in the opinion of Liszt, "one may guess which nation would be likely to benefit most from this association, an association which was to be based on the principle of equal privilege for all members," unquote. And by the way, I would note that not only is the coming European Monetary Union the realization of the theories proposed by Liszt, but the dominant power in the world now, of course, is not Great Britain, but is the United States. So I think from a practical geopolitical standpoint, one can replace England or Great Britain with the United States. It should be noted that as the Germans conquered the nations of Europe in World War II, their economic infrastructures were subordinated to those of Germany, which gave Germany a profound economic control over the rest of Europe even after the formal end of hostilities. That is one of the factors that has propelled Germany to the dominant position it is in Europe, and I suspect eventually the world as well. This was described by Paul Winkler as follows in The Thousand-Year Conspiracy. Now, bear in mind, of course, he was writing during the course of World War II, and he was writing in 1943. Winkler writes, "Until the present, this operation has succeeded much more completely in a country like France, where local authorities have accepted the idea of collaboration, than in countries occupied against the resistance of their governments. In France, capture of control of corporations through forced sale to Germans took place with a show of legality because French authorities and courts, under pressure from Vichy, countenanced these transactions. The Prusso-Teutonics know that military occupation of France cannot last forever. Besides, they have probably considered the possibility of a German defeat, which would bring about the fall of the Nazi regime. They must have said to themselves that even in that case, conquest of France would have yielded them the key advantages they had hoped to gain. They figured that it would be extremely difficult for the French to find the legal forms to get rid of German control over nearly the whole of their national economy. This control having thus been established within legal framework according to French law, the task of destroying it would be arduous and complicated. This would be true even for a government under no obligation to respect the agreements of Vichy. It would, of course, be more true for any French government recognizing Vichy laws and decrees. All of this entered into the preparation for what Hitler calls the New Economic Order. This new order is in its entirety the old Prussian scheme of Liszt, which 90 years before Hitler's reign provided the blueprint for the creation of European economic unity under domination of a Prussian Germany. One more time, this new order is in its entirety the old Prussian scheme of Liszt, which 90 years before Hitler's reign provided the blueprint for the creation of European economic unity under domination of a Prussian Germany. It also provided for subsequent expansion of this Prusso-Teutonic Europe through invasion of the markets of other continents and establishment of, quote, protectorates, unquote, throughout the world. This scheme had always been close to the hearts of the Prusso-Teutonic powers of Germany and had been placed by Dr. Schacht and Dr. Funk in the foreground of the aims pursued by Hitler. By the way, Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht was the first and most prominent of Hitler's finance ministers. Continuing, territorial conquest has a meaning subordinate to economic conquest, according to Liszt's formula. And again, it is that formula for conquest through economic control, dovetailed with military conquest for political control that we saw under the Third Reich, that has ultimately led to Germany's domination of Europe, and ultimately to the realization of what Friedrich Liszt had envisioned in the 1840s, with basically Germany having assumed dominance over the United Kingdom. What remains to be seen now is whether Germany assumes dominance over the United States as well, something that in many ways appears to be happening. That excerpt again came from the Thousand Year Conspiracy, subtitled Secret Germany Behind the Mask, authored by Pan-German expert, or expert on Pan-Germanism, Paul Winkler. It was published by Charles Scribner and Sons in 1943, and the takeover of the London Stock Exchange by the Deutsche Börse is to be seen against the background of that particular excerpt from, for the record, program number 85, and in turn from the Winkler book. You've heard allusion to the various tapes that I've produced over the years, including For the Record programs 99 and 85. All of those tapes, the For the Record tapes, as well as the archive shows and tapes of many of the lectures that I've done, are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, capital S-P-I-T, actually, just on the, yeah, capital S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. Again, Spitfire, capital S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. The email address for Spitfire, this would be small case, of course, spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. And you can see a list of and description of the various programs available from Spitfire on the Real Audio Equipped Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. That's www.spitfirelist.com. A matching list is available on the KFJC website at kfjc.org. Look in the Transmissions and Public Affairs section. That concludes the first side of For the Record Program 232, Can You Picture Us in London? Or How the United Kingdom Lost the Second World War. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.